If you didn't kill him, then who did, sir?
Who can say? Best thing for him, really. His therapy was going nowhere. I've been in this room for 8 years now, Clarice. I know they will never ever let me out while I'm alive. What I want is a view. I want a window where I can see a tree, or even water. I want to be in a federal institution far away from Dr. Chilton.
What did you mean by fledgling killer? Are you saying that he's killed again?
I'm offering you a psychological profile in Buffalo Bill, based on the case evidence. I'll help you catch him, Clarice.
You know who he is, don't you? Tell me who decapitated your patient, Doctor.
All good things to those who wait.
All right, hello. Welcome back. This is David.
Hey, this is Tim.
Yeah, and we're back to see you again. Thanks for tuning back in. We appreciate that. We're so glad you're with us today because we're excited about this one. I am, but it's going to be a good one. But before we get there, Tim, how's your week been? What have you been doing?
It's been pretty good. I've had the last couple of days off, which is a rarity, so I'm a little relaxed and rested.
Awesome.
Been catching up on some TV and some reading.
Good. Always good. I never have as much chance to read as I want to, but I do try to catch up on the TV because I travel a lot. So all the flights, I'm always watching something because I don't find it easy to sleep on a plane. So I tend to download and watch something. Thank God Netflix lets you download now. It's awesome.
You know, I've never had to do that, but I do that with podcasts all the time so that I have them on my phone and I can listen to
them. That's cool. Mm-hmm. That keeps it together. I guess the big thing for me this week has been the premiere of the first new Star Trek series in 12, 13 years, which I was so excited about, and then I'm not. And I'm serious. You know, I'm a huge, huge Trekkie. I think I've even mentioned on the podcast before how influential Star Trek has been in my life. I mean, since I was a kid, and how much I love it and everything else. And I'm just not impressed with this one, So
I've always been a fan of the original series. I was never a big fan of anything that followed. But I'm excited, I wanted to see it. I knew it was set, before the original series in the timeline. But I haven't had a chance to watch it. It's on my DVR and I will watch it. I will not subscribe no matter how good it is though, because I don't need CBS on demand.
Oh yeah, what a mistake that's going to be, I think. I mean, I read that they had 10 million people watch the premiere on Sunday. So I was going, okay, great ratings. That would be awesome. But I bet their ratings on episode 2, 3, and 4 are not 10 million people. Because for those of you who don't know and aren't into Geekosaurus land like we are, CBS is launching a new, essentially online service with this, which is CBS On Demand is what they want. And they want you to pay a subscription, just like you do for Netflix or for other things, in order to watch Star Trek. And I as much as I love it, I agree with you. I'm not going to do that. And I say as much as I love it, meaning the original series, not what they've done with this. Because I did watch it, and I'm not impressed. It's severely JJ influenced. I got to say that, even though they keep denying it, it really is. So. Anyway, we can do an entire podcast
on that.
Oh my gosh. Let's have more lens flare. Ooh, awesome. Anyway. So yeah, we could do it, and maybe we will do a podcast about that. But this week we're excited. I think we're both excited. Are you excited? I'm excited.
Oh, I'm very, very excited.
Yes.
Do I sound it? he says in a somnambulistic tone.
Well, because literally this is probably one of my top 10 movies. This is in my top 10 movies of all time, this particular movie. I have watched it innumerable times. I think that it is so well done. And you know how opinionated I am about everything, but I will say this movie, there's probably nothing I would change about this movie anywhere in it. From music to cutting to lighting to casting, dialogue, probably nothing that I could think of. In the rewatch, I could not. Again, I was just sitting there taking notes and loving it.
Yeah, you know, I would probably put it in my top 10 as well. My top 10 always changes, but the top, I wouldn't put it in my top 5, but I would definitely put it in my top 10.
Yeah, yeah. So for those of you who didn't get the hook at the beginning and you're just tuning in now or whatever, or didn't download that part about, we're talking about Jonathan Demme's Silence of the Lambs.
You spook easily, Starling?
Not yet, sir.
I guess we should say it's more Thomas Harris.
Thomas Harris.
It's more Harris's Silence of the Lambs because it is so faithful to the book, too, I think. And I think that's a great thing. And we'll talk about that when we get to the literary, because there's a couple things I really like about the literary aspects of this film. But very popular film, probably the first, wasn't it the first horror movie that ever won an Academy Award?
It may have been the first ever nominated that I can recall.
That could be true too.
I mean, would Jaws count?
Jaws was not nominated.
Well, I don't think it was nominated for Best Picture, but I think it was nominated for certain awards and stuff.
Possibly. I'd have to look because I know Jaws didn't win a lot. Jaws is always credited as the first blockbuster. Literally, that word kind of got coined with Jaws. But another one of my top 10, by the way. But this movie, very modest budget, $20 million under that, but grossed over $250. It 7 nominations for Oscars, and it won 5. And I think it's only the 3rd movie in history to win all 5 categories. So
it is. And I knew what the other 2 were. And one of them is One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, which we both have in common.
That's correct.
Having done that on stage.
Yep. It went through a huge, I think one of the keys that came from this, and I'll just go ahead and say it now, is I think it's been hugely influential on filmmaking since it came out. Mostly due to the point of view photography and the way Demme approached it and the character development of it.
Agreed. And we'll get to keys later, but there are 2 of our favorite television series that were both inspired by this movie.
So, yes.
Yeah. That'll come near the end. That's a little teaser for you if you don't know what that is.
So 5 Academy Awards, including Best Picture, Best Director, Best Supporting, Best Actor, Best Actress, and Best Screenplay. And so maybe we start there. Let's start at the beginning and give a little history. So Thomas Harris had written a book prior to this, which was Red Dragon. And
actually, he had written 2 prior to this.
Oh, really?
He did one called Black Sunday. That was his first novel.
Oh, okay. That was Bruce Dern in a movie. So he'd written 2, but I remember reading when they came out in paperback, because I remember Red Dragon was out in paperback when Silence came out in hardback. And then I remember reading, because my first memory of Silence was the paperback at the bookstore, the cover with the butterfly on it. It was like a silver... Mm-hmm. A silver butterfly, I think, was on that paperback edition. It had the death's head moth on it, not a butterfly.
Right.
And that was, I just remember reading it and being really intrigued. And I read it first, and then I read Red Dragon and went back, because I had missed Red Dragon when it first came out.
Same here. And I think we read it at the same time, because I think I was living with you at the time.
I think that's true.
Mm-hmm. And then when I told my mother how great it was, she kind of raked me over the coals and said, I tried to get you to read Red Dragon years ago.
Well, I remember Red Dragon. The thing about Red Dragon was the blurb on the back was, once you find out how he selects his victims, you'll never feel safe again. Which,
unless you live in the modern world,
right? Which was true back then. I mean, not so much now, but true back then. And right. And any of you listening who have not read Red Dragon, not seen the movie or seen the original Manhunter movie, but not read it, please go read it, because it's an excellent book. And so is Silence, by the way. I think they're both literarily strong pieces of writing for novels.
I would say that the book Silence is put together as carefully as the film is edited. The chapter sequence, the mm-hmm. chapter length, and the depiction of events in chronological order, it's very, very well done.
Yes.
The book is as good as the movie.
Interesting. That's good. I found it interesting in both the novels, actually all three of the Lecter novels, if you want to call it that, which are Red Dragon, Silence, and then Hannibal. He deals with dual villains, which I think is kind of rare in novels. I think King does it occasionally, but I can't remember another author that has two villains in every book kind of thing. Lecter's like in all three, but all three also have a primary sort of villain in each, from Dollar Hyde to James Gum in Silence, and then the Verger character, the crazy pig guy in Hannibal. And I found that very interesting. It's hard enough, I think, for screenplay writers and movie makers to create successful singular villains, but to create two in one movie that are both as terrifying and scary and unique, I think is a challenge.
Yeah, I agree. And now that you kind of put me on the spot, because I can't really think of another film, and I'm sure there is one, that uses dual villains other than a hokey Batman movie.
Yeah, or Avengers or something, or but even they have singulars. I'm trying to think, too. We may have to do some research and look into that, but I can't think of another dual villain right now.
Right. And it's interesting how they play Hannibal versus James Gum, whereas Hannibal is like hyper intelligent, but Gum isn't necessarily. He's just very crafty and creative. And I did not mean that as the pun it sounded like by the crafty comment. What I meant as far as like acquiring his victims and stuff, which is actually he's loosely based on several different serial killers that are out there that we may touch upon later.
Yes.
Using an arm cast to conk someone over the head while they're helping you load a sofa into a van. That was actually done by somebody else.
Well, yeah, I think we should talk about that. I mean, I know that Harris, from what this research I did, Harris did a lot of research into serial killers to actually create James Gum. And Dollar Hyde in the first one. And a plug, and what I want to get to, the screenplay for this was written by Ted Talley. And one of the reasons you and I both come from theater and love theater and have performed on stage and backstage and everywhere else, and the one thing I like and I think is a strong asset to this movie is Ted Talley was the screenplay writer, and he came from theater. And he had written several comedies, a couple of other things, but he's very good at scene structure and character development and putting stuff together. And that's why I think this one is best adaptation, because of his translation of Harris and being able to do it in such a cinematic way, but still a great storytelling way. But you were saying inspired by, so let's go back to that. So James Gum was inspired by several real life, true serial killers. Do you have that? I know who you were mentioning the first time.
You know, I don't have it in front of me. One was Ted Bundy, obviously.
Obviously.
There's some Ed Gein in there as well.
Uh-huh. Definitely agree with that.
As far as the sewing together of a suit or a mask or what have you. I did come across something that might even be a little more interesting. For a long time, Harris did not reveal who Lecter was based on. And it turns out Lecter was actually based on somebody that did exist. He was a Mexican surgeon named Alfredo Bali Trevino, who was convicted of murdering and chopping up his gay lover. And
Really?
apparently, yes, back in the late 60s, I'm kind of scanning the article now because it's long. He was working for maybe when he was working for the Associated Press, because he's from Jackson, Tennessee. This is Harris, by the way. Then he moved to Mississippi, and then he eventually ended up in New York, where he worked for the Associated Press while he wrote Black Sunday. And at one point, he had to interview this doctor I just mentioned, Trevino. And apparently, there was, I don't know, some kind of scuffle with money, and Trevino ended up killing his lover, is the word they use. I don't know if they were partners or long term. And he put him, he drugged him, put him in the bathtub, slit his throat, drained the blood from his body, and then sliced it up into tiny pieces and put it into a box. Then he took the box to a farm and told, it was a relative's farm, told him that it was medical waste that he needed to bury, and they got suspicious, and the guy called the cops, and they dug it up and found out. So this is who Hannibal was based on.
I did not know that. That is great.
Yeah, I came across that a few days ago.
I did know that in an interview, Ted Talley said that he based his Lecter, as far as the translation of Lecter, or always saw him as like Moriarty, Sherlock Holmes' arch rival. He always thought of him that way, that manipulative, that strong, that intelligent, and a great foil for whomever he's against. So I thought that was kind of cool that they based it on that.
Yeah, I can see that.
I mean, you're big on history of production and stuff, and one of the things that I found out in looking at this was Orion Pictures, which is no longer around, bought the rights, and they bought them with the help of Gene Hackman, who wanted to star in it. And I'm assuming by star in it, he wanted to play Lecter. I don't think he was going to play Clarice, so I'm assuming that, or they were going to rewrite it, so he was the, a male. Clarice became a male. I
He
don't
could have
know.
played Crawford.
Yeah, but that's not star in it, really. I mean,
No, it wouldn't be a vehicle for him, no.
But Hackman was actually the one that hired Ted Talley, the playwright, because he had seen a couple of plays that he had done on Broadway. And then when Hackman actually saw the screenplay adaptation, he went, "No, I really can't do this. It's too dark. I don't want to do it. Can't do it." So then it kind of went into limbo for a while until they tried to get Demme to do it, and Demme at first declined because he thought it was just a slasher horror movie, and he had done a bunch of comedies and didn't want to do a slasher horror movie. So I thought that was cool. And what was the other prep one? I had a couple of prep things in here I wanted to tell you. Oh, a question for you. Where was it filmed? Do you know where it was filmed?
Where was Silence
Silence of the
filmed?
Lambs.
Well, some of it was filmed at Quantico, wasn't it?
Yeah, the whole opening section, they actually got Quantico, and that was great too. They got FBI permission to actually use the real Quantico to do it. But where was the bulk of the movie filmed? Do you know? This is great trivia. You'll love it.
I think I know, but I can't remember.
Pittsburgh.
Yes. I'm actually looking at a screen that says most of the film was shot around Pittsburgh. That's
Yeah.
hilarious. It was right in front of me.
I thought that was awesome. I thought that was really cool that, it's Night of the Living Dead again, but even better.
Well, and if we get into the trivia, I mean, there's a couple of cameos that are very famous in there as well.
In silence?
In Silence, yeah.
Okay, save that
Two
for when we
very
start.
famous directors make cameos in this movie.
Well, yeah, save that for when we start going through it. I want to know. Yeah, but pre-production wise, though.
Okay.
So,
That's another teaser.
and we keep saying later on we'll talk about this.
We're getting good at this podcasting stuff.
Ooh, hang on. Don't switch. Oh, the other one was in an interview, Hopkins said that he asked Jonathan Demme, "Why did you hire me?" Why did you hire me for this part? And Dimmy said, I hired you because I saw your performance in The Elephant Man. And Hopkins said, that's totally different. He's a sympathetic hero doctor character in The Elephant Man. And he said, right. And you play that well. And Hannibal doesn't lose that. He's still a very empathetic character. And that will help you play him as a better villain. And I thought that was brilliant. I just thought, that's a cool idea of a compassion. You know, it's kind of what makes Anthony Perkins' performance in Psycho work, is because he's a compassionate Looney Tune.
Good example.
Yeah.
It's very funny that you bring up Psycho, because that's also based on Ed Gein as well. But you're also, back to what you were saying as far as the director-actor relationship, I mean, it's obvious that Hitchcock saw something similar in Anthony Perkins. And when you have someone that, like Demme, who is really, really good at what he does, and then someone like Anthony Hopkins, who is just an extraordinary actor, the combination is, you know, probably 80% of the magic of that film, even though he is only in 24 minutes and 52 seconds of that film.
Wow. I did not know the time frame.
You remember that.
Great.
Yeah, he won an Oscar, and he won an Oscar for 24 minutes and 52 seconds. And the only other actor that has done something similar was David Niven in a movie called Separate Tables, and his was 23 minutes and 39 seconds.
Interesting.
So I didn't mean to digress, but no. What I was trying to get at basically was the brilliance of both the director and Hopkins. And like, for instance, another thing I thought that was really cool was Hopkins wore white for a reason.
Mm.
And it was because he wanted to play on people's fear of doctors and dentists. And he thought he would be scarier in white.
It worked. Definitely worked.
Yeah. I mean, who would think of that, you know?
Yeah, I also remember in another interview, they asked him, because the first real scene they filmed was the scene in the prison, the first scene where Clarice and Lecter meet, because Demme felt that that would strengthen the cast for the rest of the shoot if they had that initial meeting first. And he asked Hopkins, what do you want? Do you want to be laying on the bunk? You want to be sitting down writing? What do you want to be? And he goes, oh, no, I'll be standing. And he goes, you want to stand to meet her? He goes, oh, yeah, he would be ready for her. He would like to stand to meet her. First, she's a woman, and he would want to do that. And he goes, how does he even know she's there? He's a woman. He goes, oh, he'd smell her. Mm-hmm. And I thought, see, that's just creepy. That's awesome that you thought about it that much.
I mean, and he even knows the cologne she wears in the book. I mean, that's not just in the movie. That's in the book as well.
Yeah, yeah. Nice touch. Great. It gives him, it shows this multi-sensory kind of beast that, you know, you don't know. It's going to be hard to con him or to deal with him. So I thought that was great. Production design. I mean, if we're talking about production before we dive into the actual, you know, the movie itself, but I thought production design all the way through, it was awesome. The design of the cell with no bars using the plexiglass was just brilliant for what they wanted to do from the close-ups. The music, one of my favorite soundtracks ever, and you know how much I love soundtracks and listen to them. And that sounds odd that, you know, people say on the plane, what are you listening to? I go, Silence of the Lambs. You know, but I...
Yeah, who am I sitting next to?
But it's written by Howard Shore, you know, who also did Lord of the Rings. He did a bunch of Cronenberg movies. He also did a bunch of Scorsese. I mean, it's non-traditional horror music, which is why I think, again, this movie works so well. It's because they buck tradition so much all the way through. It's very orchestral and soothing and lyrical, which makes it even creepier feeling. So I really like that.
I really like that it's composed of a lot of POV shots.
Yes.
You know, from Clarice or from Lecter. And then it all climaxes at the end when you have the POV of Gum with the night vision goggles. And it's like, wow, it structurally, that makes as much sense as the way the book is structured, like I was saying earlier, with its chapters.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big, elaborate puzzle, and every single piece fits.
Yes. And that POV is an important thing, because not a lot of people had done that before, and I think people have tried to do it since and not done it as effectively. But when you go back and analyze this movie from the POV, I mean, from the very beginning, it's taken from Starling's point of view. There's only, I think, one scene that actually deviates from Starling's point of view in the entire movie. And to capture that, he uses these intense close-ups. And I remember even when it came out, all the Hollywood critics were freaking out that he had been so successful with putting, as they would say, Anthony Hopkins and Jodie Foster's face on a 60-foot wide screen. Because literally, sometimes he even cuts off their foreheads or their chins. It's just the eyes almost, and that kind of stuff. And the way they look directly at you, directly at the camera while they're performing it, but will you and the audience feel like, okay, Hannibal's looking right at me, sort of thing. Mm-hmm. And the times when they don't, they look just a little bit off, almost like that interview style, but it's still a close-up of their face. It's very cool. That POV is awesome.
Yeah. I mean, the cover of the book is a close-up of Clarice's face.
Yeah, yeah, and the poster.
With the moth on her mouth.
Yep.
The one I remember anyway.
The movie poster is that, with the death's head moth and covering her mouth kind of thing.
Actually, you're right. Maybe I'm just thinking of that. Maybe the movie tie-in of the book was that. You're right. It is the poster that I'm thinking of.
Yeah, which is, again, one of my favorite posters. We said it's from Clarice's point of view. I think that's another literary allusion here. I mean, and almost a key going back to, let's say, Alien, because you have a strong female. I mean, this movie is from the point of view of a strong female, and she carries the bulk of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a lot of people, when you talk about silence, the first thing they do is say Lecter. Of course, that's true. But Clarice is also very dynamic in the script and in the movie. And plays it very well. I thought Jodie Foster did a great job.
He's got real physical strength, cautious, precise, and he's never impulsive. He'll never stop.
Yeah, you know, she tried to buy the rights, and Hackman's the one that beat her to it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, she tried to get it, and he beat her to it, probably because he was a bigger power player back then than she was. I wouldn't say that's the same now.
Mm-hmm.
And then when you said he turned it down for its darkness, apparently he had just finished Mississippi Burning and was a little burnt out on dark movies. So that's another one of the reasons.
I could understand.
And another little bit of trivia is Ed Harris actually, I think, turned down the Crawford role as well.
Yeah, I think there were several. I checked my notes here, but I think I wrote down there were several that actually turned down roles in this. Gene Hackman, Michelle Pfeiffer, Robert Duvall.
Correct. Because she had done Married to the Mob with Demme, and he was her first choice. I mean, she was his first choice.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so it's interesting. I've got this note here, which is great. So essentially, a bunch of second string people ended up making one of the most popular, profitable, and award-winning horror movies in history. Because Hopkins at that time wasn't this big, huge deal, and Jodie really wasn't either. She had won an Oscar years and years ago, but she really hadn't accused.
Well, actually, she won an Oscar the year prior, didn't she? For The Accused?
Yeah. I've just got that too. Yeah. The Accused.
Yeah.
So she was probably
just getting clout.
Yeah. She was getting clout. Orion was a new studio. Nobody had heard of Ted Talley. Nobody had heard of the, designers. So it's very interesting that it got what it did with such, quote, second string kind of people.
Yeah, and Hopkins wasn't on the radar mainstream-wise, but he was on my radar ever since that movie Magic.
Oh, my gosh, yes. See, and that's what I expected. You know, if he says, why did you cast me in as Hannibal Lecter? It seems like, to me, would have said, because I saw you in Magic, and it worked, but he didn't. He used Elephant Man. But yeah, Magic. Oh, I still have that poster.
Yeah, that's a great movie.
That's a great movie. And it's very, It doesn't make a lot of lists of people's horror movies or best horror movies, but it's a great horror movie.
It makes my list of scariest commercial I ever saw as a kid.
Oh, yes. Definitely.
That commercial could send me running out of a room.
Well, I also have in my production notes that Silence of the Lambs opened on February 14th. So what a great Valentine's Day present. Okay, cool. So first time, do you remember the first time you saw it?
Vaguely. I have another interesting story to tell about it that I'll tell in a minute. But the first time, I'm quite sure I saw it with my mother, because I had moved to Sandersville by then, because that was in like 1990, I believe. And we had both read the book, so I'm sure I saw it with my mother.
Okay.
But we did go to the movie theater to see it.
I am trying to remember. I honestly, as much as I love this movie, I cannot remember the first time I saw it, which is odd.
I can tell you an interesting perspective that sticks in my head.
Yeah.
About 10 years ago, Dennis and I flew out to LA to visit some friends of his, or a friend of his. And we only had a couple of days in Hollywood, and I had never been, and I was wanting to do some cool stuff, like go to Hollywood Forever Cemetery and that kind of thing. And because I'm that kind of guy, I hang out at cemeteries. And the partner of the guy we were visiting at the time was the director of the Gay Men's Chorus of LA. And he had a friend that was the caretaker or manager or whatever of the Max Factor Hollywood Museum. And back then, it's an old Art Deco building. It's really cool. It's like where in the 30s and 40s, people like Lucille Ball and Marilyn Monroe were made up. It used to be, it's partially it's a makeup museum, but now it's a little more Hollywood museum. And it was closed that day, but his friend graciously opened it for us. So we got to basically go there without anybody intruding. It was just us in that big building. And their basement is sort of a chamber of horrors kind of thing. And they have an exact replica of the hallway Starling walks down before she gets to Lecter's cell. So I actually could put myself in that POV of walking down the hall and turning and seeing that plexiglass cell. And let me tell you what, that's some pretty creepy shit. He wasn't. I mean, if he had been standing there, I would have, you know, screamed and ran. But obviously, he wasn't there, and they didn't have some cheap dummy or anything. It was just the empty cell. But that was a one of a kind experience for me. And since I don't really have a first, I don't really remember the first time I saw the film that well. That's what sticks out to me, is walking down that hall.
That's interesting, and because it was such a pivotal scenic design moment, too. You know, I mean, because I remember, well, in watching it, I remember how gothic that felt. You know, the bars on the one side, and then just the stonework, and she has to go to the very end, and she passes, you know, Miggs and the other guy on the way, and then when she finally gets there, it's not the bars; it's this clean plexiglass sort of thing, and we're prepped for it by all the stuff that he says about don't get close to him, don't do any of that, you know, all that kind of stuff.
I love that
Chilton says to her. Yeah, and the fact that they go into that one ante room and it's all red when he shows her the picture of the nurse, and it just kind of makes you start,
and you're afraid you're going to miss something.
Yeah.
Because you're afraid that guy's going to get you, you know. They really build up his character in just a few lines, and it's very rapid fire and very, I mean, it's scary.
I'm going to show you why we insist on such precautions. On the afternoon of July 8, 1981, he complained of chest pains and was taken to the dispensary. His mouthpiece and restraints were removed for an EKG. When the nurse leaned over him, he did this to her. The doctors managed to reset her jaw, more or less, save one of her eyes. His pulse never got above 85, even when he ate her tongue.
Yeah, and the way it, again, takes it from her point of view, so she's suddenly thrust from Chilton, showing her this picture that we don't get to see, so our imagination goes, oh my gosh, what does she look like with her face bitten off or whatever? Mm-hmm. And then he takes her into the scene and she sees Barney, the friendly orderly. Mm-hmm. But everything else in that room is guns and electronics and security and everything. And then he says, there you go. And she has to walk down that hallway.
And it is weird that you brought up that it's kind of gothic, because it is. It's bizarre. It almost looks like a dungeon.
Yeah, and that was the production designer's intent, because Manhunter, who had come out before, he's in a very white, pristine, modern jail, Hannibal is. And in the book, I think, I believe too, it's a very nondescript, typical prison. He's in solitary, but it is a typical prison. But to make it this goth, even outside, it looks like a gothic castle kind of thing, that location right. They found in Pittsburgh.
I read that they didn't use bars mainly because they didn't like the shadows on his face.
Yeah, but and Demme said he couldn't get those close-ups.
Right, mm-hmm. Exactly. It makes sense from a production standpoint, because you get a better view of him and you want to see him because he's the money. He's part of the money. Jody's pretty good, too. With that rapid fire thing that Chilton does is about, you know, as far as, you know, passing things through the drawer, don't get close, blah, 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 blah. You wouldn't want to get close to him with bars because he could reach out and grab you. The plexiglass makes perfect mm-hmm. sense. And it also gives a great juxtaposition to the dungeon wall. It's like, here is this creepy dungeon, but our, you know, hero / villain is pristine and in his own plastic box, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's interesting. I'm sure that you could probably read more into it, even.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, I think it says a lot, you know, using the thick plexiglass, the little holes for air, that kind of stuff, you know, gerbil cage. I read one person called it that sort of thing. But it does make perfect sense that you wouldn't want to have any contact with him at all because he's so dangerous.
Mm-hmm.
And I also found it kind of interesting that scene is a fairly long scene between him and her on their first meeting. And watching it again this week, I was going, you know, I don't think a modern movie could get away with that, with a scene that long, that dialogue heavy with just two people, without fast editing, you know, cutting away. Everything now is so choppy and so fast and so, quote, MTV to me, that to have a lingering scene like that, that is, to Ted Talley's thing, kind of theatrical, made it scarier to me and made it better. You're looking for stuff to happen and you're kind of watching stuff.
I've never put it into that kind of perspective. I guess I didn't realize that a lot of modern movies don't do that anymore. It's a shame because, I mean, that's what draws you in.
Mm-hmm.
Those mm-hmm. long shots, the silence between lines and dialogue, you know, that's what sucks you in and gets you involved on a personal level with the movie.
Right.
I don't understand why people don't do that more.
I think Hopkins is a genius of the micro expression, of just the little, a little glitch here, a little slight turn of the lip, the way he glances away. He's just so good at that. I mean, everybody saw it in Westworld, which, by the way, he got totally robbed of the Emmy. I just want to say that because he deserved it. I don't care how good This Is Us is. I don't care how good a performance he did. Hopkins was better. So mm-hmm. I'm just saying that for the record. That sucked, and I was pretty pissed off.
I agree. It was a great show.
But let's talk. Okay, let's talk about the movie then. So, like I said, love the music. I mean, I've got a ton of notes here. What do you have as far as your perceptions of the movie itself and things that you love, didn't love, would change, wouldn't change, whatever?
I love the opening credits. I think the font is very generic almost. It's not, it almost looks a little cheap, but I mm-hmm. love that it starts with Clarice doing an obstacle course that's in the woods, because to me the whole time she's going through that obstacle course is just a metaphor for the entire film, where she's overcoming something.
I also think it's clever because it's a horror movie that starts out with a woman running, you know, and you kind of say, is she, you don't realize at first that it's an obstacle course, really. I mean, she starts out climbing up the rope, but the hill, but you're still going, is she jogging? Is she running? Is she, what is this? But a woman running is kind of a cool metaphor too, but I hadn't thought about it as a metaphor for the whole movie. Handling the obstacles, navigating herself in a man's world. That's kind of cool.
It's that. It's the dealing with the case itself. It's dealing with her own personal demons. Everything she's doing in this movie is to overcome whatever is, you know, forcing her back. I also, we just mentioned the scene with her and him, the first scene. And I just, all I wrote in my notes was perfection. That scene is perfect. Mm-hmm. There's nothing wrong with that scene whatsoever. I love when they have a flashback and she's walking to the Pinto, but when it flashes back, it's her dad's police car. I think that was a really tasteful way to insert just a little brief bit of history on her.
Perfect.
And you just, overall, the way Demme shoots the film, other than all the glorious stuff with Lecter and the creepy as hell shit with Gum, anytime Clarice is on the screen, you root for her. I mean, and that's not just Demme, that's her. I mean, that's Jodie Foster at her best. And I mean, I just have never, maybe again, it's back to what we were saying with the long close-ups and the dialogue and, you know, not a lot of choppy editing, is you just feel for these people. I mean, that's another reason why some people kind of like Lecter, is because he is likable for a psychopath.
Yeah, I think he's human. He's very played very realistically, you know. Mm-hmm. And I think Clarice is really too. I think it says a lot about them as actors and also about Demme as a director that they could pull that off. Mm-hmm. You know, you can't really. A lot of actors even now couldn't pull off a close-up of your face for this entire scene. And that moment in the first scene with Lecter where she is bluffing. She says something to the effect of, "Doctor, that's very childish of you. I expected a lot more." And he, like, stands up to her. And she, like, you can see it in her face. She's terrified but not going to show it. And now I'm going to say something else, but what am I going to say? I don't know. And I'm just going to say, no, it's just like this. You know, sort of. It was so well done. Those little thoughts about it. I loved it.
Like
I love the
fencing. You know.
Yes.
Back to what you were saying. I can't remember the exact line, but there's a point where she says something about, and if you'll just kindly fill out this form or whatever, and he goes, you were doing well. You had it here, and you did this, and you did that, but then you did that, and that's not good. Or whatever. I was like, God, he's just so smart.
Yeah.
Memory agents, darling, is what I have instead of a view.
Well, perhaps you'd care to lend us your view on this questionnaire, sir.
Oh, no, 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 no. You were doing fine. You had been courteous and receptive to courtesy. You had established trust with the embarrassing truth about Miggs. And now this ham-handed segue into your questionnaire. It won't do.
I think you're so dead on with we root for her. I mean, we struggle with her as she struggles in these scenes. The first time meeting Lecter, the first time meeting Crawford. And having to be in his office. And I love the fact that at the beginning, you know, he's not even there. Mm-hmm. She's left alone in that office and sees all of those pictures and all
Plus
those headlines.
Plus, she has to deal with that shit Chilton, who, you know, is not shit, but he's not only trying to get in her pants, but he's also trying to get promoted. Another reason we root for her is because Lecter roots for her.
Oh, yeah, great. Yeah, that's
And
good.
Then you also, I mean, and another reason we like Lecter is because even if he is an evil man, it's almost because he's almost, I mean, for what we know, he's killing evil men. He likes Barney. Barney's a friend of his. He wasn't going to kill Barney.
Yeah.
Because
he
Barney's
never would.
Good to him.
Yeah. But he will kill those that are in his way or that offend him, especially. That's big in the book, is he doesn't like to be offended. Yeah. And that's why, you know, and but you just hear about it off camera, so to speak, or off stage, let's use that theatrical term, with Miggs. And the fact that Miggs does that to her when she exits. And then later on, we hear from Crawford that Miggs choked on his own tongue. And you're going, you don't know how, but you know Lecter had something to do with it.
Right.
He somehow made it happen. You know, it reminded me, thinking about it literarily again and going back to that, this is like a hero story, except the hero's a woman. Mm-hmm. You know, she's the hero of this. She has to go fight the dragon. Ha, ha, ha. Pardon the pun.
Mm-hmm.
And to do that, she has all of these challenges she has to go through, kind of thing. Or, you know, she has to go kill the monster, but she has to face monsters to do that. You know, and she's rescuing. Oh, I just thought she's rescuing a princess.
So, I don't know about your definition of princess.
Well,
get me
well,
out of here, you stupid bitch. Don't you leave me. Yes.
Your little dog's down here. But yeah, but I mean, a girl. So a girl in peril, she has to rescue instead of. Oh, I just saw a great quote. Okay, two points from the beginning section and getting up to that. In my notes here, I say, based on characters, Jack Crawford was actually based on John Douglas, according to Thomas Harris. And John Douglas was the founder of the Behavioral Sciences Division.
Oh, okay.
FBI headquarters. So he was actually based on a real guy. And I saw in the thing that Scott Glenn actually went and talked to Douglas several times about how you deal with that.
Do you know who Anthony Hopkins was using to do Lecter?
No.
It's an amalgamation of three. Truman Capote, Catherine Hepburn.
Oh, I see that. I see that,
and Hal from A Space Odyssey.
Oh, the yeah, I can see that.
I can see all three of them.
Yeah, that makes excellent sense to me.
Because there's a very feminine side to it.
Yeah.
And that's the Hepburn.
Yeah, there is a there's a delicacy to him. Mm-hmm. You know, the way he, especially when they're in Tennessee later on, and the way he's conducting, and the way he hands her the manuscripts, I mean, the drawings and all that. Case file.
Touches her finger.
But in the first scene with her, the one, you know, everybody quotes the fava bean line. That's the big one that everybody remembers. It's become cliche from that.
A census taker once tried to test me. I ate his liver with some fava beans and a nice Chianti.
But the one that got me the most was, I'm trying to think of the exact words for it. He says, what does he do, this man you seek, this Billy, mm-hmm. what does he do? And she says, he kills women. He goes, nope, that's inconsequential. What does he do? And she goes, he skins them. He maybe does it because, and he goes, why? And she goes, because a trophy. Most serial killers keep trophies. And he goes, I didn't. And she immediately goes, no, you ate yours. And the next shot of him is like, nice. Good job, girl. That's, you know, and I just, and again, it's just like you said, I hadn't realized I was doing it, but you're right. I was rooting for her. I was going, yeah, get him. You got him. Mm-hmm. Kind of thing. Nice moments. Let's see. So, I mean, so many nice in this movie. The so much works, you know, when she goes and they examine the body and she has to kind of use her feminine little girl charms to get rid of the big old policeman boys who are worried. And then coming back to Lecter, after she's heard from Crawford that Miggs has died, she comes back to give him the big sell, like you said, the whole con job of the fill out the survey and all that
right,
kind of stuff.
Right.
Another nice moment is, she goes, that's beneath you, doctor. Frankly, it's something that Miggs would say. And he just glances at her and goes, not anymore.
Not anymore. Yeah. And both those lines are almost throwaways. Like when she says, you yeah. are yours, or he says, not anymore, they're almost throwaways. And that's their craft. I mean, that's good acting.
That is. Yeah. Very much so. A side note trivia thing I saw here. When they do that scene with the latest victim in wherever they are, Pennsylvania or wherever, they have to do the autopsy, and they use the
mentholatum.
They use the mentholatum, everything else. When they pull the moth, the pupa, from her throat, Demi had the audio guy add a gasp there. He said, I want to hear her last breath.
Yeah.
And if you watch the movie, it happens. You can hear it. It's really cool. But it's those subliminal little things that you wouldn't notice, but they achieve this horror factor all the way through it.
Right.
I was thinking about little details that they do, that they tell the story without having to spoon feed us stuff. You know, like you said, lines that are throwaways, but they're so impactful. Or like, you know, yeah, Miggs died in his cell. We infer Lecter had something to do with it, but we're not told that. And we're never shown that. No. They just show the lingering kind of shot of the pin on the pillow that Chilton leaves behind. And we almost even forget about it until we finally see it with the handcuffs.
Yeah.
You know, kind of thing. Or when he takes it out of his mouth. But so little things like that, the pin being
subtle.
Left behind. Yeah. Yeah,
but
and played so well.
Another great
scene I have in here that I said was really good was the scene with the senator. It's still so offensive and so almost funny in places, and you just go, "Oh my god!"
Yeah, that's
but you
not
know,
in
who
the
would
book.
End? Who would end a scene like that? Would love the shoes. It's just so good.
I think the shoe line is in the book, but the toughen your nipples line is not, because he ends up trying to play the senator a little bit because there's a brief time in the book where you can tell he's trying to play both sides in order to get out of that dungeon or whatever. And he works a little more with the senator in the book than he does in the movie.
Yeah, I think there's more negotiation going on and stuff like that. Right. But I think we kind of see that condensed in this scene.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's obvious manipulation going on, and we know it. Again, that POV, we know it, but she doesn't.
Yeah.
It's that, you know, we're seeing things from, and that's one of those moments where it's a non-Starling point of view. The whole being transferred to Tennessee. We don't have Starling in that. But everything else is really from her point of view. Kind of thing. What is it? Love the suit. That's it. That's the line. Mm-hmm. Love the suit. Tennessee. I went, you know, even when I first saw this movie, I went, woohoo, we're in Tennessee. Oh, that's not good. but again, production design. That whole flaying the guy and hanging him up with looks like angel wings, backlit cell in the middle of the room kind of thing. That was really cool production design.
Mm-hmm. You want me to touch upon a cameo, because one is in that scene.
Sure.
When I believe it's when Chilton walks in with two guards.
Mm-hmm.
One of them is George Romero.
Mm-mm.
Yes, sir.
No way.
I
never knew that. No way.
Mm-hmm. You can go back and look. You'll see.
Oh, my God. That's awesome. I did not know that.
Yeah.
I have to.
And then the
go
other
back
director
now.
Cameo that I was mentioning earlier is in the FBI somewhere, and it's Roger Corman.
Yeah, he's the head of the FBI.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. So you've got Roger Corman and George Romero are both in this movie. That's
wow.
pretty.
Wow. Two?
That's pretty big.
Two big horror icons, definitely, in one film. That's great.
Mm-hmm.
When Clarice finally comes into that scene, she goes to Tennessee to pursue him to find out that last quid pro quo doctor thing.
Mm-hmm.
He again, it's brilliant the way it's written and performed and directed. I mean, so many levels. But he says, like, "Good evening, Clarice," but he doesn't even turn around. Again, he knows she's coming before she even shows up. and says that. Little stuff in that scene that I loved. I love the whole, just the again, Demi's photography is just that simple stroke of his finger on hers. The only time they ever touch.
Mm-hmm.
It's just played up, and we don't know why. We don't know, is it good or bad? We do, and we start making our own conclusions from that about the way they care about each other, feel about each other, and or whatever. It's just really great. The
Maybe
fact
she
that then
he's overcoming his own demons too.
Yeah, it could be. She thinks, oh, I'm helping him in some way or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That whole scene, the way he lingers on that, you know, the camera kind of pans over the charcoal drawing, and we realize it's Clarice and a lamb that he's been drawing about her, which kind of gives a lot of subtext. The fact that, you know, it's right beside a Bon Appetit magazine, kind of like, uh-oh.
Oh, and did you know that Thomas Harris went to Le Cordon Bleu and is a chef?
No.
Yeah.
Great trivia, that one.
Yeah, I
That's
thought that
excellent.
Was hysterical. I was like, oh, well, I know where that comes now.
Well, and I like the fact that, again, some of his cutting and editing that I like. I liked so showing the pin earlier, and now suddenly we know why, kind of thing, and figure it out. We cut at the end of this entire sequence. We cut from him, Lecter, sitting up in the back of the ambulance and pulling the face off, and suddenly we cut to her friend running down the hallway, and then it just cuts to her going, to them talking about him leaving. She doesn't bust in and say, Lecter's escaped. She doesn't. We don't see her find out that information. All those three scenes are butted right together, but we know exactly what's happening. And I just think that's excellent cutting and excellent writing.
Uh-huh.
It also makes us feel more paranoid and scared because, again, we're getting it from Clarice's perspective. And then I guess my final thing about cutting or editing it was the scene where Clarice finally goes to James Gum's house. And it's intercut with the scene where Crawford and the guys are doing the storming. The FBI guys are storming the house.
And you think that they're on the right track when actually she is.
Correct. And even down to ringing the doorbell turns off the red light, turns on the red light down below where Gum is.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I read
when he opens
that
it's an oh shit moment. Oh shit.
Yeah.
It's
and
him.
Then it suddenly cuts to them busting in and nobody's there, and it zooms in on Crawford's face and he goes, Clarice. And then we suddenly cut back to her and Gum. You know, I think it's really interesting that he cut it that way, and I was curious about it, so I looked it up and found out the original editor, when he edited it, put it in sequence. So it was all the Crawford stuff, then going to Clarice, ringing the doorbell, walking up, ringing the doorbell, the establishing shot, blah, 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 blah.
No, you got to shake that
and
shit
the edit, And the editor was the one that actually suggested to Demi, these should happen at the same time. We should cross-edit these. And it works so well. It just really does.
And that's the way I write. I mean, I've only written a couple of books. But the first book I wrote, I was like, I don't want this to be in order. I want things to be moved around so that the history plays in later. And that's how he edits this. And I love that. I love that that some of it's not in sequence.
Yeah, and I think it does something for us as a viewer, kind of psychologically, because we are definitely told at that moment Clarice is alone. Anybody who could help her or could be there to save her is in another state, in another city. So it kind of really isolates her, and that works all the way through that scene, even going down to, you know, now our second version of a dungeon, a literal dungeon
right.
with Gum, and the fact that he's excavated this. excavated this home and turned it into this, you know, multi-room labyrinth kind of thing. Again, going back to that hero mythos of you got to fight the dragon at the end kind of thing. You had mentioned earlier the night vision goggles. So you like that guy
too?
Yeah.
It increases the claustrophobia of a claustrophobic moment.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they're already in tight quarters, and she's in a place that she's never been in the dark. So, she is smothering, and then you see his perspective when he's like reaching out, and you see that hand just almost touching her. It is so fucking creepy, and you're just like, girl, turn around.
Well, and all of, you know, again, great cutting, great subtlety.
Isn't it the only time we have his perspective?
No, well, I mean, we see a little bit of it, like when he sees her back, when he first takes her and goes, oh, and barely touches her back kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And then, but yeah, I just thought of this. We don't have any close-ups of Gum other than the one where he starts out looking at his own kind of camera and backs up. And does this "what if I'm a girl" scene?
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Yeah,
but we don't have him in those intense close-ups. He's always seen from like the bottom of the well, or far away in the room. You know, even when he's always shown from a distance. Even when Clarice first arrives and sees him, he's at the other end of the room, and then he's over near the kitchen door, and all of that. That's an interesting take that I hadn't thought of. I did like the way he did little things in it. You know, Demi used real moths. So, you know, what gives him away is she sees the moth on the knitting stuff.
It's on his
Other
robe,
than that,
isn't
she
it?
Wouldn't really have known. Huh?
I thought she saw it, like, on the back of his robe or the sleeve of his robe or something when they're in the kitchen.
No, it's like a live moth that flutters over beside him over near where he's kind of leaning on the cabinet or the credenza or whatever.
I may be confusing the book. And in the book, she starts putting, you know, he's a lead that she's not really that, she doesn't think is really that concrete. And it has to do with a woman that owned a tailor shop. And I'm assuming in the movie that moldering body that's in the bathtub may have been that woman. I don't know.
Yeah, I think it's the woman that he got from the house. It's her house that he apprenticing in or whatever. And so, yeah, I think he left her.
It's all extraneous. But in the novel, I think it's explained a little bit more. But, yeah.
Yeah, but again, I think it's one of those where if you knew the book, yay, great. If you didn't know the book, it didn't interfere with anything. But it added to, it's another element that you went, oh, okay, so there's that. You know, we never see him put on a skin suit, but we imagine what putting on a skin suit would be, and that makes it even worse.
All because of her line about the darts, recognizing the darts as far as a pattern. You know, that's really all we need to know exactly what he's doing.
Right. The scene where, you know, Catherine is in the well at the very beginning. She doesn't know what's happening, what's going to happen. And she looks up and sees the fingernail in the wall. Mm-hmm. And that's when she starts screaming. And not only, and again, the creep factor, she starts screaming and we go, oh, my gosh. And we kind of get scared. But then he starts screaming and acting like her.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't know if he's making fun of her or if he's like trying to experience what she's experienced, whatever. But it just makes it creepier.
Right.
I had a question I wanted to ask you about Gum. So I know Ted Levine plays that character. I think it's endemic of him now. Even seeing him in crime dramas, I still see him as James Gum.
Oh, yeah.
So unfortunately, he's kind of associated with that character, mostly because he does have an extremely distinctive voice and a kind of look to him, too. But reading the novel,
Sutherland-ish.
Yeah, I could see that. But reading the novel and then watching the movie, is James Gum gay?
I don't think so. And, you know, when this movie came out, it got a lot of flack from the gay community.
Right. Even protesting the Academy Awards.
Correct. And, you know, that's why Demi went on to do Philadelphia. That was kind of an apologetic movie.
Mm-hmm.
But in the book, Harris goes through a lot of measures to, and he does this through Lecter and through this character that is a doctor at a sex change clinic. in Baltimore,
Mm-hmm.
Where they're basically trying to distance him from the transgender community too. They're saying that that he has a mental illness, not necessarily, you know, because he wants to be a female. You know, what he is just one of a kind. He is not, but he had considered trans sexual surgery or sexual reassignment surgery, that's what it's called. And he was rejected because of his mental problems. Yeah, so and I guess some of that wasn't made as clear in the movie as it was in the book by Harris. And you know how people have to have something to protest.
That's why I wanted to ask you about it, because I never thought Gum was gay watching the movie. As a matter of fact, he seems like he doesn't seem like, and I don't think he's a transsexual or a, you know, a transvestite even. We see him with the robe and doing his dance, and that's probably the most, not offensive, but you know what I mean? That's probably the most.
Most of him trying to imagine himself as a woman by making his penis disappear.
Right. Right.
Mean,
so,
like
but
a,
I think.
Better words.
But and I may be influenced by the book too, because I like the book a lot. But I think it's more that Gum, because he was so heavily abused as a child, he saw his mom as powerful, dominant, the controller, the strong one. His father was very henpecked until he died and then he's gone, kind of thing. And so I think he wants to be powerful. So he wants to be his mother. He wants to be a woman, because women to him, he equates with power. That's kind of my take on it.
You could also remove all the sexual labeling / terminology and go to the metaphor of the wanting to be something else. And that's where the chrysalis and the pupas with the moths come in. He's looking for some kind of ultimate transformation.
Mm-hmm.
That doesn't have to be sexual at all.
And if you think about it, literarily, that's kind of what Harris did in all three novels. Because Dolarhyde is wanting to become. He's wanting to transform into the dragon. And that's kind of the thing he wants to do. And Verger in Hannibal, who's been horribly maimed by Lecter, and he wants to transform himself into a powerful figure that can kill his arch enemy, kind of thing, and become this most, he's worked on becoming this powerful, wealthy, social, you know, recluse kind of thing. So that transformation thing seems to be running through all three of the novels.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that's common with writers. Sometimes they get stuck on themes, even though sometimes it's subconsciously.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But, yeah, I don't, I didn't find, I mean, as a gay man, even now, some of this transgender stuff is so new that I'm just getting a grasp of some of the things that are going on. But even with what I'm hearing now about, you know, transvestitism, transgenderism, drag queens, none of that really fits neatly into what Harris was doing in this book. That guy's a psychopath.
Mm-hmm.
Pure and simple. And you know what? So what if he's gay? And so what if his Lecter's? A lot of people think Lecter's gay. So what? You know, gay people can kill people too. You know, they can.
Okay.
You know, there are bad gay people. I know plenty of them.
I want to go to a horror science fiction and have that on my t-shirt. That's what I want.
So, you know, don't get up in an uproar, you know. You know,
oh, I agree.
People just have to protest. Fuck people.
Well, we've gone through I've gone through most of my notes. If you have two, do you want to talk about keys or whatever keys that you think this one possesses?
Yeah, we can. I don't have as many for this one, but I do have two that are just blatantly obvious. You probably already have those as well.
Go ahead.
Well, as far as inspiration, Silence of the Lambs is almost directly responsible for both the X-Files and Twin Peaks. I mean, both those series are so heavily derived from this movie.
I could see that, definitely.
I mean, all the way down to the strength of Scully and the strength of Starling. I mean, yeah, Clarice Starling.
Yeah.
And then you've also got the moth insect geeks who are so much like the Lone Gunman. It is just hilarious. And one of them has a crush on Starling, and Chris Carter made one of the Lone Gunmen have a crush on Gillian
Scully.
Anderson's character. Scully.
Yeah.
Did I mix up the names? I didn't mean
to. No, that's all. No, that's.
Yeah. Yeah. There's a lot of X-Files that was born out of this movie. Now, the whole FBI, you know, investigating a murder and going to another town, you know, that's where Twin Peaks comes in, and you're more of an authority on that than I am.
Yeah, very, very good. That's very good.
You know, like the pulling of Laura Palmer's body out of the water and the autopsy is very similar to the scene with the autopsy and the moth, pupa in the mouth. How many times can we say pupa, by the way?
Let's try for 9.
It's a fun word.
I think also FBI influence, of course, Criminal Minds. I don't think you would have a Criminal Minds today if Silence hadn't been as successful as it was and done what it did. I think precursors to this or keys that inspired this, I think, were definitely Hitchcock. Whole POV kind of angle, the psycho elements, that kind of stuff, I think, inspired Demme and the team. I also think Alien, of course, is a key to this, that strong woman hero in a movie. And Night of the Living Dead, the same way. That strong, singular hero kind of story put into this environment, I think, is a bit of a key for
it. A little less hysterical.
I think there are other direct keys, of course. The Hannibal sequel to this, which I did not like. The Red Dragon remake came after this, where they actually used Anthony Hopkins as Lecter instead of the actor who played him in Manhunter.
Brian something.
Yeah, I think CSI, not just because of the connection to Manhunter, but also because of the way that story was told of embracing the forensics guys, but the police procedural changed in a different way kind of thing. And the last one I have is the new, and I haven't watched it, honestly, and I probably should, the series Hannibal.
You know, I hear great things about it, but I haven't seen it either.
I do too. Same thing. I have not seen it, but I like Mads Mikkelsen. I think he's a great actor. It'd be interesting. I guess eventually I will have to see it.
Yeah. Yeah. It's on my list.
And I think overall, this movie just challenged actors, writers, and directors to do better, to create better villains, to create better heroes, to tell better stories.
Great screenplays.
Oh, my gosh.
I mean, it's so minimal and says so much.
Yes.
Why do you think he removes their skins, Agent Starling? Throw me with your acumen.
It excites him. Most serial killers keep some sort of trophies from their victims.
I didn't.
No. No, you ate yours.
I think, I'm sure that somewhere it's taught in the screenplay classes, just because it is so, it's so bare bones, but great, but perfect in what it tells and what it implies. Mm-hmm. I think that's as we kind of wrap up, that's one of the things, I texted you earlier this week and said, give me a list of some good horror movies for like teenagers and stuff, because I think that's one of the problems with modern horror is there's not any subtlety to it. Everything has to be a jump scare. Everything has to be in your face. Everything has to be that kind of tense moment where something's going to jump out at you, as opposed to characters who are compellingly scary and you're not sure of what's going to happen. You're more suspenseful unease than you are jump scare, freak out, scream sort of thing.
And
I think
we may
missing.
Do this at some time, but the movie Scream is probably worthy of a podcast because Wes Craven made fun of all that stuff 20 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. You know. It was that offshoot of the slasher movies and where they are, and they haven't evolved from them. They tried to evolve in horror, tried to evolve into the found footage whole genre. That didn't work. Torture porn was here for a while. Well, it's coming back because Saw is coming back, but that doesn't work for me as far as appreciating good horror, what I think is good horror.
No, when you asked me, I wasn't sure what your criteria was, and I was thinking, you know, maybe it needs to be movies that are a little more modern if it's a younger person. So I was trying, you know, to scrape up some that I think work that are more modern. That's why I suggested It Follows and The Descent, because it's not, you know, Annabelle or whatever the fuck the new doll movie is, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
Or Mama. Not a big fan. Yeah, there's so many out there. I think I saw Insipid. Is that one? I don't know. They all sound the same.
I know. They all sound the suck. Yeah, that's what they are. Yeah. I mean, one of the ones I also recommended was The Ring, because I do think The Ring is good.
Oh, The Ring is good.
I think, but it's that way. It's very atmospheric. It's told very well. It's not just jump scares. It's, oh my gosh, something's going to happen, suspense building. You know, mm-hmm. So that to me is more horror anyway.
And Guillermo is very atmospheric as well.
Okay, any last thoughts on Silence?
Yeah, I guess we should get back to the subject, huh?
Details.
Let's see. Well, we mentioned keys. One other key that you could throw in there at random would be Texas Chainsaw Massacre. And that's mm-hmm. basically mm-hmm. because both it and Psycho, which we've already mentioned, are loosely based on Ed Gein, and so is Jane Gumm. I mentioned earlier that he is an amalgamation of several serial killers, and they were Ted Bundy, Ed Gein, and some guy, I can't find it now, that I've never heard of. Obviously, the Ted Bundy stuff was as far as him capturing his victims or his girls.
Right, how he captured.
The Ed Gein stuff was, you know, what he did with their body parts or their skins or whatever.
Right.
So that's where the Texas Chainsaw Massacre thing comes in, because there's a little bit of that in that movie as well. So that's all I had for keys. And really, overall, I mean, if we just want to give, you know, final thoughts on the film, I think we encompassed a lot of that at the beginning. You know, it's yep. up there in the top 10 movies ever.
Yep. It's brilliant. It's awesome. We highly recommend it. If you have not seen it, go see it. If you have seen it, go see it again, because it's really good. Buy it on
Amazon.
Yeah,
you'll catch more on multiple viewings, especially... Definitely. Performance wise by the main actors.
Cool.
And don't see it alone.
Yeah.
I do wish we could chat longer, but I'm having an old friend for dinner. Bye.
Thank you again for listening to Johnny Has the Keys podcast. You can contact us through our website, johnnyhasthekeys.com. And please don't forget to subscribe, rate, and review us on your podcasting app of choice. Johnny Has the Keys is supported in part via Patreon. For as little as a cup of coffee a month, help keep our podcast commercial free. The link is at the website. See you next show, and don't lose your keys!
Thank you.